Hey there, y'all. We'll get to that episode that you pressed play on in just a second, but I wanted to make sure you knew that the club is opening again for new members next Tuesday, April 30th. The club is a virtual community of parents of kids with big, baffling behaviors and vulnerable nervous systems, and you can read all about it over at robingoble.com/the club. If you already get emails from me, you'll get a message on the 30th reminding you that the club is open. Otherwise, set yourself a calendar reminder to go to robingoble.com/the club next Tuesday, the 30th. Alrighty, let's get to that show you're waiting for.
So when your kid's behavior is baffling, and yours is too sometimes, yeah, I know. Let's take a break from all the bamboozle here on the baffling.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the Baffling Behavior Show. It's me, Robin Goble. But today, y'all, today I have a super special guest, Jessica Sinarski, who you might know from Riley the Brave or her new book that just came out, Light Up the Learning Brain. Jessica actually has way more books. I think she told me that Light Up the Learning Brain is her 9th. You're definitely going to want to go check out Jessica after this conversation if you don't already know her and get all her resources. Jessica and I have been friends for many years, colleagues first, and then over time we've just developed a closer and closer relationship. And we thought it would be fun if we got together and did a live webinar together all about bringing attachment science into action and how that can help us who wear this professional hat, how that can help us really find a way to love our work again. If you listen to the Baffling Behavior Show as a parent, I encourage you to stick around anyway. There are so many parallels between the professional experience, working with kids with vulnerable nervous systems, working from an attachment brain-based perspective. There's just so many parallels to parenting kids with vulnerable nervous systems from an attachment brain-based perspective. So even if you're a parent, not a professional, I encourage you to stick around. I think you'll get a lot out of this conversation. Jessica and I start by just chatting about kind of how when we realized that what we knew, what to do with kids, wasn't going to be helpful in working with kids with such vulnerability in their nervous system, particularly trauma and attachment histories. And so again, if you're listening as a parent, you may also remember the moment you realized that what you knew about parenting or what you knew about children really just wasn't adequate for caring for kids with histories of vulnerable nervous systems, these big baffling behaviors, and you know, this attachment trauma history, right? Again, huge parallels. And so we both share our experiences of when we realized, I think I'm really missing something here. And then our journeys of putting attachment science really into practice in a way that was useful for the clients who were coming to us. We also chat a little bit about what to do or how to navigate if you are shifting from a more behavioral approach to a more attachment, trauma, relational neuroscience-based approach in your practice, how we can take steps to be able to make that shift for ourselves and for our clients. And we kind of muse about the relief when we really realized we don't have to know all or even most of the answers. So again, if you're tuning in as a parent, I think you can see how this conversation is really going to parallel, because that's true for us as parents too, right? Like the relief we can feel once we start to really believe the truth that we don't have to have, it's not impossible. It's not possible to have all the answers. So anyway, without any further delay, I'm just going to hit play and get us into this really fun conversation that Jess and I had just a few weeks ago about how to love our work again by bringing attachment science into practice. Here you go, y'all.
Robin and I connected several years ago. I don't even remember how I came across your work. It was right at the beginning of when I was writing Riley the Brave. And I think I reached out for a consult, I want to say, because I was figuring out some of the professional end and maybe training. I don't remember. Anyway.
I don't remember.
And since then, we actually finally met in person. Finally. In 2022.
Yep. I feel like, and I know that Kendra is here, that Kendra from Orr Park is really responsible for... and I actually think that's true. I think Kendra was like,
100%.
You know, Jessica, you need to know what she's doing. And probably was the same on the other end. And then, of course, we have such a lovely relationship with Orr Park.
Yes. Wow. Yay, Orr Park, indeed. So, yes, that's exactly what happened. Because I remember Kendra had, we had connected around Riley the Brave, and I did some speaking for them. And Kendra said something very kind afterwards. And then she's like, and we have high standards, like Robin Goble. And I was like, oh, crap. I don't know who Robin Goble is.
I didn't know that is.
And indeed, she was correct. It was high standards. And so it's really been through this mutual passion for understanding the brain and what behavior really is, and even the animal metaphor concept.
Yep, exactly.
That has, I think, united us across the miles. And I think the other thing, too, has been a real passion for, or at least this is what I've sensed in our conversations over the years, is a real passion for helping, for supporting not just the kid, but all of the adults around the kid, and understanding that that is what's needed. Like, if we're thinking from a child first perspective, we have to think about how we're supporting family and teachers and counselors and therapists and social workers and everybody involved. And so that shared commitment and passion, I think, also brought us together.
Yeah, I totally agree. And then from like this relational theme of like, you know, I'm sure everybody here can relate. Like, we're constantly on the lookout for people that we feel really seen by. And in doing this work, that feels hard to find a lot of times. And so I think when we find those people that we feel like such resonance with and so seen by, right? Of like, we love these kids, we love their parents, we love this work, we love the science. And we love also making the science useful, right?
Yes.
Because those things don't always all go together. And that feels like such a, like this very conversation we're having today feels like such a part of like our synergy and why it's just been so easy.
Yeah.
Despite only meeting one time.
That's right. I agree. Yeah. I agree with all of that, because I think the, what part of just the impetus for us getting together today with all of you is that I felt a lot early in my career, like, this is so hard, this is so hard, this is so hard. And as I sort of stumbled into attachment and trauma and the brain and bottom-up approaches and really understanding even the balance between those body-based practices and boundaries and healthy communication, and that doesn't mean you're a doormat, or like that these being a therapeutic parent, or, you know, working from a brain-based perspective doesn't mean being permissive or being taken advantage of. And I think those nuances, you know, I love the chance to tease that out a little bit. So maybe that's where we'll dive in a little bit, is as I was thinking, I mean, there's a lot of directions we could go today, But one thing that was super eye-opening for me as I started understanding more about neurobiology and especially related to trauma and attachment is that so many of the practices, so many of the modalities that I was taught in graduate school or early in my career weren't reaching the part of the brain that was hurting. In my kids, you know, in the kids I was working with, in the adults I was working with, and, you know, we're trying to think our way to better functioning, different functioning, seeing certain behaviors as maladaptive, and come to realize all behavior makes sense. And your survival, your way of surviving is good and fine, and it served you. And maybe there are even times it's still serving you. And so just thinking my way through isn't going to fix it. And fixing it isn't even the goal in the first place, but that's a whole nother conversation. So I don't know, Robin, can you think of any aha moments, or what was your approach into this world of like, whoa, this is different and it feels good?
I'm interrupting the show real quick because if you happen to be a new listener, you might find yourself being a little overwhelmed by all this information. That makes total sense. I mean, there's like 150 episodes plus all the free resources that are available over my website. It's just a lot. So many folks have asked me, where do I start? So I created a separate podcast stream called Start Here. What I did is I took the 10 episodes that I want you to listen to first, and that I want you to listen to in this specific order, and I put them into a separate podcast stream so that you don't have to search for them. You can just press play and they'll play one after the other after the other. If you go to robingoble.com/start here, you'll be able to get an invitation to subscribe, and then you'll be able to listen right in the same podcast app you're using right now. robingoble.com/start here.
I remember super clearly, and I maybe have written about it in the book. If I haven't, I've just talked about it a lot. Like, it's a really clear story for me. And it doesn't start with this feels good. It starts with this feels bad. That like, I think this is similar for you. Always wanted to do this work with this specific population. And when I actually got to truly do it, like no internships, no nothing like that, but like really, I'm like a grown up doing work with, you know, these kids and their families, how quickly I realized, oh, these kids and families have been to like a million therapists mm-hmm. before me. I have no idea what I'm doing. And that's gotten increasingly obvious in such a short period of time, because the tools I was equipped with were like laughable, right? Like the room was destroyed.
Yep.
Or I really truly left the office with a black eye, like an outpatient mental health therapy. I left with a serious black eye once. And there was such a clear, like, I have no idea what I'm doing. This feels bad.
Yes.
I also am not willing to keep referring these people out, because they've been referred out 47,000 times to even get to me. So I guess I have to figure out like what's happening here. And I was super lucky that I was connected in Austin, when I lived in Austin at the time, with a mentor who was really steeped in neurobiology and attachment and trauma. And so he really helped first validate me, right? Like, you're right. The things you're trained with actually aren't helpful.
Yep.
And it's not because you're bad at this. It's because you just haven't learned these other things yet. And so like to bring some hope and some clarity to that piece, and then really dive into the neuroscience. And I know, I think we're pretty similar on this. Like, I've just been like obsessively seeking, how does this behavior, like, what, why is this happening?
Yes. So I feel like what you're describing, maybe some of you who are here today can relate, and maybe you're in that phase right now. Maybe you're moving through that phase or remember those times. or maybe you didn't have to experience it because you had a different, a different, training or, you know, I know there are improvements happening. It's just slow. It's slow for the science to catch up in a way that it translates to action. And so right out of the gate, I was working in the South Bronx in foster care and had a very similar, like, I didn't know what I didn't know. I just knew that what I knew was not enough and not really equipping me to come alongside in the ways that I wanted to. And it wrecked me for a while. Like, my family was concerned about me. It was a hot mess there for a while. And I also feel really fortunate to have been able to learn and grow a lot with John Balin, who is just obsessed with the brain in the most delightful way. And I had that same hunger of like, why is this happening? Like, I was seeing these miscommunications galore where the kid is trying everything they know to try, which mostly looks like bad behavior. And the parents, be they birth, foster, adoptive, you know, grandparents, whoever it is, are trying all the things they know to try. And then, like you, I've heard my whole career, a therapist told us to do this, or our social worker said he'll ask about adoption when he wants to know about adoption, or, you know, we heard this from so-and-so, and it breaks my heart. And so that is part of, I think, both of our commitment to you to say, it doesn't have to be like this. Like, you don't have to be alone with it. It shouldn't be so hard to find this information. And so, and that if you're feeling that disconnect, like how you've been practicing or what you learned doesn't fit with the science that you're learning now, or it's not resonating with you, pay attention to that. So that actually brings me to one of the questions that we got ahead of time. I'm in the midst of a personal and professional paradigm shift. My work is successful in that my caseload is always full. I have a niche and a good reputation, but my work is no longer aligned with what I'm learning about connection, co-regulation, neuroception. It's currently primarily behavioral based. Any advice as I think about pivoting my work from a less behavioral approach? I feel like I'll be starting over professionally and give up my current success, so to speak. Mm. So my immediate response was, do it, make the switch. But I'm curious, Robin, if you have a what your response to that pain point might be.
Yeah, I mean, I hear the fear of, what if I, you know, take a risk, show up as truly me, and people don't like it? And that hurts me, like, both personally and professionally.
Yeah.
And so my first thought in that is like, oh man, do we all not know that feeling in some way?
Yep.
And especially when you add into it, like, these are our jobs, and in Western capitalistic society, it's how we survive, right? And so that gets scary too. Like, you know, losing clients is hard in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, my first thought is like, that's really, really scary. And my second thought is, I'm a huge believer that both us and our clients really deserve the opportunity to fully consent to how we're working. And my clients deserve the opportunity to fully consent to how I work. And if they really want a behavioral-based model, and I'm starting to shift away from that, that's a conversation that we all, like, really deserve to have, so that they can make a choice about where they want to get, you know, the help that they want. And probably some people actually will decide they want something else.
Yep.
And that's believe it or not, going to be okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think, yeah, I agree. I feel like that honoring of the relationship is part of putting the science into practice, that it's not, yeah. This isn't just transactional. I think therapy is such a, or social work, like these helping professions are so funny in that I realize someone's paying me in part for my expertise and education and, you know, tools and all of that stuff. But there's a little part of it that's like, someone's paying me to listen to you, like to be in relationship with you is sort of how it feels sometimes, because yeah. I loved being a therapist. I'm not yeah. in practice right now, but I love that. And I remember a mentor saying something similar to me years ago when I was feeling stuck with a client, that it's okay to bring that in the room. So whether the stuckness is around, you know, what you've learned and what you're trying to put in practice in healthy ways, and that shift that was the heart of the question that we just were talking about, or if that stuckness is related to something else. And I think I think this happens in every aspect of therapeutic practice, but particularly when we're working with parents, with kids who have big baffling behaviors, with kids who have experienced trauma, kids who experience the world a little bit differently than maybe mm-hmm. I do, kids who have, you know, fetal alcohol exposure, like there are all of these reasons that a child's behavior may be really tough and really tough for the family, really tough at school, really tough in the world. And so I think one of the misnomers I get sometimes when talking about how I practice or teaching about, you know, interpersonal neurobiology is that that is a little bit of like all or nothing thinking, that you're either directive or non-directive, or you're either for the child or for the parent, or you're either behavioral or not, whatever not is. But the reality is behavior comes from the brain. And so in my mind, there's so much more gray in the middle of all of that, which is messy and hard, but also I think brings some freedom. So I feel like there's two directions I want to go, and maybe to start with is to think about that, how interpersonal neurobiology informs stuckness in particularly in the therapeutic or social work kind of relationship. I don't know if you want to jump in on that topic.
Well, as you're talking, one of the things I keep coming back to that's related to what you just said too, is if we're going to, when thinking about, you know, turning attachment theory into practice, how we can really utilize the parallel process. So, you know, whether we're talking about stuckness or whether we're talking about our fear of switching away from behavior-based model, like we're having the same experiences that the parents of the kids we work with are experiencing. And that helps me come back into like connection, compassion, empathy for them and for me, right? That like, of course, parents are afraid to switch out of a behavior-based model. We are too.
Yeah.
Right. There's so much vulnerability in that, right? Like as we lean into trusting what can't be seen, that's really scary, especially because these kids' behaviors are scary and dangerous.
Yeah.
At the very least, their families are struggling so mightily, right? And then and really, truly, so many times they're scary and dangerous. Like we're not talking about annoying behavior, although we're talking about that too.
But I was gonna say, sometimes we are, but
totally, for sure. That is true as well. But so many of the kids that sort of, I think, end up in our offices and probably in the offices of people who have logged on, right? That because we're finding ourselves in this kind of like crisis of switching to a different model, or because we're really wanting to think about attachment theory and put it into practice, most of us are working with kids who have pretty intense behaviors. So there's a sense of urgency.
Yes.
From our experience of like, I mean, how many times I still am at risk of this, of like, kind of really like, this feels so big. This feels so big. And then turning to someone and essentially saying to them, tell me what to do.
Yeah.
Which is the same thing that parents are doing.
Right.
Right. And so of course they're so scared to think about anything outside like a cause and effect behavior-based model, which for me is where a lot of what can feel like stuckness happens, right? Like there's a stuckness between me and the parents, maybe about like, this thing's not getting better, or tell me what to do to make this thing better. Or I've done what you've said and it's still not getting better, so I don't want to do it anymore. Like those, that's kind of what I think about. And I feel the word stuck.
Yes. I think that's spot on. And I think the fear component is helpful. And I think you were talking about a parallel process. We had a question in the chat. There's this parallel process that's happening. Like, nervous systems are nervous systems. So as a therapist, as a clinical supervisor, I bring my brain and body into the room, right? And I think understanding the neurobiology of fear and how that plays into relationship, like that, exactly what you're talking about, that parallel process of like, when the parent is feeling frenetic about these, sometimes annoying, and I want to tell them to just chill out, and sometimes truly concerning, life-threatening, dangerous kinds of behaviors, I feel that same thing with the adults that I'm working with, right? I feel that same sense of like, they're coming to me, that sort of fight flight activation. And this, I think, is where the polyvagal theory, which also informs both of our work mightily, is so, so helpful, because I can check in with myself of, is this coming from a steady, grounded, centered place, which doesn't mean calm, which doesn't mean happy, but from my upstairs brain, right? Or is this my fight flight activation? Is this that sympathetic activation that, and now I'm striving, I'm paddling, I'm in a state that is not helping to steady the other person. And often the other person I'm trying to steady is the parent, or the, you know, the other professional that I'm working with, or the teacher or the school counselor. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I think of it sometimes, in case this is helpful for anyone, over the last couple of years, I've been really drawn to like hawks and, you know, some of those big birds, a lot over here on the East Coast. And I find myself feeling something. I can't quite put my finger on the feeling, but when I see them, and usually you see them soaring, right? You usually see them when they're up in the air. I also, my youngest really enjoys nature shows. We watch a lot of shows about nature. If you see a hawk or a raptor or an eagle or whatever, when they are getting off the ground, it is ugly. Like, it is not a great picture. Right. And so one of the things I think about a lot is, and if polyvagal is totally unfamiliar to you, let this just be the metaphor that it is. Don't worry about the words or names. But I think of that, you know, ventral vagal state, that upstairs brain state, as that soaring state where I'm aware, I can shift, I can do the things I need to do. But so often, without real connection, not just with knowing enough, but without real connection, I find myself flapping. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I'll check in with myself when I have a new project or when I'm feeling worn out. Am I flapping? Am I fallen? Right? Am I all the way down in that dorsal vagal collapse state? Or is this coming from, you know, and you can just feel it in your body. Is this coming from that soaring state, which you're not going to be in all the time? It's not like, I think that was another one of those misnomers that I needed to work my way through.
Right.
That's not possible all the time. And that's not our goal for parents, and that's not our goal for kids. And so here again, we end up in these parallel processes that if we can notice them and get the support we need around the natural feelings we're having, there's a way forward.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You know, someone else kind of commented on what we were saying about, like, it just feels so scary to shift out of this place of, like, my job is to fix everything or to know the answers. And without question, I mean, my identity, if it's not obvious, you know, I learned that I made people happy by knowing lots of things, right, when I was young. And so one of the ways of taking attachment theory and putting it truly into practice is really embodying the truth that actually me staying stuck in, I've got to figure out how to answer this question or fix this problem for this person, is actually not good clinical care, mm-mm. right? Like that is, it's not criticism and I'm not shaming myself for that, but that feeling of this is my job. I'm taking responsibility for this. Somehow I should have the answer mm-hmm. is coming from, you know, we could use lots of, you know, if we were going to use sure. IPNB language, right. I could say like a state of disintegration. If we yeah. wanted to use polyvagal language, you know, we could say that's coming more from a neuro-receiving danger, from that protection yeah. mode. And that really helped me shift out of this well-earned protector.
That's right.
I have to know everything. If you ask me a question, it's because I obviously should know the answer. I mean, yes. that's how I've moved through the world and had to figure out how to be okay with actually the answer is being brave enough to really sit in a place of, I don't know.
Yeah.
In a place of curiosity, that actually is taking attachment theory and putting it in to practice. It's not really about a technique at all.
It's not. And I think that I so resonate with the, it's not a technique at all. It really changes you. We change each other. I think that's the whole deal with how brains develop, with how humans develop, is that we are intensely relational and we have ways, our brains and our bodies find ways to navigate that when something is creating some friction or when survival is on the line in whatever way that looks like. And sometimes that's in real, you know, I think many of us on this call today know plenty of real life survival was on the line. You know, this kiddo was going to die if they didn't do X, Y, and Z. And we also know plenty of those moments. For me, my physical life wasn't on the line as the kid, right? But I certainly have some of those downstairs brain protectors, some of that energy that comes from hurt and wounds, that if I'm not aware of it in life in general, but especially in this field, it is going to come out in ways that aren't fair to anyone involved, not even to me, yeah. let alone yeah. to the clients that I'm trying to serve. And so yeah. I think part of loving your work again is being able to say, I don't know, and this is really hard, and I'm here with you in it. It doesn't mean I'll never know. It doesn't mean that this person's alone and you should refer them out. But to be able in the moment, in a session, at a home visit, to sit with this is hard and sad and effed up and
Yeah, for sure.
Without the immediate like backlash I get in my body is, it doesn't mean it's going to be that way forever, right? But sometimes we have to just sit in the muck for a minute.
Yeah.
And I see a question here. That's not the question I thought it was. Sorry. So what I thought the question was getting at is, when you feel like you've been in the muck for a long time, when you feel like you've been holding space, when you feel like you're doing the relational things you're supposed to do. And I know I've gotten to this point with some clients where I'm like, it feels unethical to keep sort of treading water is what it felt like. Like we're just, you know, these are the things that I think are going to be helpful. And if you don't want to do those things, or it's hard to do, like, let's explore why those things are hard, whatever. Like I'm thinking of one client in particular, that sometimes it's okay to bring that in the room, that we can trust our clients enough to say, hey, I'm feeling really stuck. I sort of feel like we're having, from a really grounded place, make sure you've gotten good supervision and support beforehand. Mm-hmm. So you're not blaming them for your stuckness, to go in and say, you know, I feel really stuck and I'm not sure where that's coming from. We've gone round and round about, like, I think this thing will be helpful. It seems like this thing is really hard to do. Like I'm thinking about, you know, I had recommended some body-based practices and neurofeedback and some things to really help the nervous system. And it wasn't resonating or wasn't working for whatever reason. And that it's okay to be honest about that and explore with curiosity and not judgment. I feel like I'm saying that all really vaguely because I want to protect my client. Yeah. Not that they will ever see this, but I'm just super, super conscious of protecting people's stories. I wonder if that's bringing up anything for you.
Well, I think there's always this, place of getting curious about, like, is this, you know, have we reached an impasse where, like, we might want to talk about referrals or, as crude as this might sound, I really feel like when people go to McDonald's, they need to order a Big Mac. And if they go to McDonald's and they order a Whopper, they're going to be upset with what they get. Yeah. And so that, again, kind of feels like consent for me. Like, yeah, if I'm working with a client who's like, I really actually, what you're offering me isn't what I came here for.
Yeah.
I think that there's a space to really talk about that and then, yeah, and really empower the clients to be like, this isn't what you want. And that's totally fine.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, again, and this is where interpersonal neurobiology and attachment theory and really putting it into practice has been helpful of me is also thinking about it through an attachment lens, right? Is this experience that this person's having here, is their challenge in kind of doing this thing that I really believe will be helpful for them, is that giving me some information about what's happening for them neurobiologically that maybe, yes, I didn't know before, right? Like they're, you know, like when a client can come to mind for me, just like you said about, you know, really trying to do some just work on connecting to themselves, right? Like, yeah, I was asking, yep, a lot of questions, yep, like, do you notice? I'm wondering if, you know, that kind of stuff. And like, those questions weren't just, ignored. It was as if those questions never even happened. Mm-hmm. And really, at that, of course, can feel frustrating, especially, mm-hmm, if you feel like you know something that would be helpful to somebody. Mm-hmm. But really pausing to reflect on, like, in this specific situation, that person just still didn't have the internalized resources that were being built through our slow co-regulated relationship to be present with themselves. And the theory is what kind of helps me have a guess about which way do we go, right? Like, do we stay here very focused on co-regulation? Or do I start to talk to this person about, like, maybe this isn't the exact right treatment experience for you, and we want to talk about that? Yeah. And it's real hard to put that into words. Like, when would I choose one way or the other? But again, that just brings me back to, like, the theory, like grounding it in the theory and grounding in connection with myself helps me at least know that there's a couple different options and then to explore those with the client.
Yes, that I don't need to figure it out on my own. In fact, it's a little arrogant of me to think I might.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. It is. But again, with no criticism.
No, we all do.
All of us came to this work probably because it feels good to have to help people. And we like how that feels.
Yeah.
And navigating that reality with, like, actually, it's pretty paternalistic to think I know something about this person that I'm not an expert in this person.
Yeah.
They're the expert. They're here to teach me about them.
Yes. And there's freedom in that. I think that's, again, you know, coming back to this theme of loving our work again, there's freedom in not having to know all the answers. That doesn't let us off the hook of learning and doing our own work and showing up well. I'm not saying we go to just reflecting what they say and being, you know, calling it therapy. I apologize if I just offended anyone, but I think we know more now, and it is our ethical obligation to put these theories into practice and to use the science that we have. I see in the chat from the other side of therapy, sometimes we don't even know ourselves. And I think that is spot on. That's why you're there. And that's why it is the social worker or therapist or whoever's job to be genuinely in a therapeutic relationship with you so that it is safe to be you. It's safe to be seen and known by this other person and by yourself. And that's how our brains and bodies develop. We don't know ourselves first. We only know ourselves through the good enough parent or the parent that has hurt us. And so to think that it could all be cognitive, that change could all be cognitive when we're dealing with deep, deep hurts, feels short-sighted, I guess, at this point in what we know.
Yeah. And just to kind of go off of what this person said here and not go off, but to continue on with what this person said here in the comments, sometimes we don't know about ourselves. Yeah. Like, I've been that client. Like, I've been the client who sat on the couch and was like just totally baffled and confused. Like, I didn't know. In retrospect, I look back and I'm like, I didn't know myself. I didn't have a solid enough sense of myself yet. Mm-hmm. And how that emerged wasn't a therapist telling me, right? How that emerged was a therapist sitting in deep resonance, deep reflection, you know, lots of regulation through my ranting and ravings. And right, that through that experience, through seeing on their face and in their actions, you know, I learned something new about who I was, how I showed up in the world, what my value was. But I didn't learn it because she told me it.
Yes.
I learned it because of how she held herself. Just was.
Yeah.
And that can feel like such not enough.
Yeah.
But it's me being on both sides of the couch that is really what gives me the confidence it is enough, because I have been that client.
Yes. And for, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's it.
I was just thinking the other thing that's so hopeful for me in that is it's not just in a therapy client situation that that happens, that that I know who I am in part because of how I see myself through other people, not by what they say necessarily. So as you were describing that experience with your therapist, I think of my very best friend in the world and the healing force that she has been for me. I think of my yeah. husband and the ways that he has yeah. seen and known
yeah.
the worst parts of me yeah. And loved me anyway. Yeah. And how healing those relationships are. And so I think that again is the hopeful side for every single person watching this, whether you're a foster parent or a therapist or a social worker or a teacher or just a human out in the world, is that there's, while there are, I think, magical things that happen in therapy, they don't only happen in therapy.
Yeah,
relationship exactly. is relationship is relationship. And I think, so I often sign my emails, "I'm glad we're in this together," because I think that's the only way it can be. I yeah. don't have all the answers. You don't have all the answers. We're going to find our way through. So yeah. that does leave us with some of what a couple of you came with questions around. How does this work in the midst of the insurance model of care? We're going to solve all those problems in the next 14 minutes.
Mm-hmm. No, y'all, we're not. That's a joke. I do think I am not an expert in documentation. I send people to learn about how to document, but I do think there is a way to document that is honest.
Yep.
And meets the criteria of the people of the third party payers.
Yep.
And I can't teach you how to do that, but I do think it's possible. Somebody taught me how to do that. Not well enough for me to teach someone else, but I do think that's really possible to do that. Document authentically and do the work inside the session
yeah.
that we believe like resonates with us.
Yeah. And that yeah. is something we talk about. So in, you may have already heard from me about it. You will hear more about it. The Moving Beyond Trauma-Informed course that's starting soon. One of the things that we talk about is goal setting as a therapist, primarily, but certainly in social work and other things as well. That we want to be really conscientious that the science can help us set appropriate goals so that as we're documenting, we are saying the things that we are actually working on in an ethical way, that from our understanding of how brains and bodies work is the goal. And so instead of, you know, eliminating X behavior in X way, we are, you know, doing X thing to increase felt safety in the therapeutic relationship. We're working on this in the dyadic, you know, we're working to reduce blocked care for this parent in these certain ways. That blocked care is, parenting is really hard in the best of circumstances, and our brains go into protection mode. And when that protection mode gets strong, this kid is not going to get better if I'm not supporting the parent or working with a team to support the parent around that. So I think it, you know, it's complicated. There's not a quick answer to how do we do this in the world of insurance. And there are ways through. And there are frustrations along those ways and limits and points at which you might decide you can't take this certain insurance because it just never seems to go well, or you like, and that's hard and heartbreaking, but part of being able to show up for the clients that you can show up for is navigating that conscientiously. That's not the right word, but with thought and care. That it's easy for the obstacles to send us into protection mode. And so if you're here feeling, you know, sort of torn apart by some of the logistics of loving your work, oof, man, you are not alone. And I think, again, this is where connection can be so powerful and helpful, because yeah. that if we can find, like you said, you may send them to somebody who can be helpful in that space, even if that's not something that you're actively like working on. These things are important, and they are things that get in the way.
Yeah. There's a question coming I'd love to tend to, because I think it really supports like the work that you're doing, Jessica, and the way that you're teaching therapists to do this work, about like how, you know, when we're losing passion for our work due to like kind of like information overload in a way, right? Like there's so many theories, there's so many modalities, we're taught all this stuff. And then that almost can leave us like sort of in the opposite place of feeling like there's so much to know, I could never possibly know all of it. And there can feel like a lot of overwhelm and that. And it, that also kind of goes along with another thought that I'd been having earlier, which is, I think it's easy to leave these kinds of conversations or trainings that are about attachment and relationship and interpersonal neurobiology to think that what we're saying is all you have to do is show up in the room and bring your relationship voila, everything's no. We're not suggesting that you don't have a lot of tools in your toolbox. But what we are suggesting is that the tools you use are wide and varied. The tools can be offered up inside what like the interpersonal neurobiology is telling us about like resonance and serve and return, right? It doesn't matter if I'm doing EMDR, somatic experiencing, or TheraPlay, or whatever. I mean, some of the modalities matter a little when we think about the place in the brain that we're trying to target. But beyond that, some of us love Santre. Some of us love play therapy. Some of us love movement-based work. Some of us, like, we all have different loves. And I actually think that's the most important part. Like, if I love an intervention, I'm going to show up with resonance and, you know, curiosity with it. And then I'm going to offer it in this foundation of the attachment theory and the interpersonal neurobiology. And so I think my experience, Jess, I'd love to hear what you have to say, but this question that this person is asking about, like, learning too much, you know, it feels like a pretty normal part of the therapeutic professional development trajectory, that because of our culture, but because of grad school, because of insurance companies, because of so many things, we spend a lot of time, I feel like, early in our career getting lots of tools.
Yeah.
And this is normal
and
not bad. And I think it's just a part of development that we have to go through. And then there comes a point where we start to notice what really resonates with us, when we start to realize like, oh, this tool is not any better than the next tool. They're all sort of doing the same thing. It's kind of like, which tool do I like better? Which tool do my clients like better? But I actually do think it's important to think about, what do I like better? Because those clients will be the ones, you know, who come to us, and staying like really connected to those interventions, and then getting really grounded with ourselves.
Yeah.
That is kind of the next professional development step, is connection to ourselves, trust in ourselves, trust that we don't need all of these tools. They're there.
Yeah.
But they're not really what the magic is. And so I think a summary of my very long-winded thoughts there are, I think it's helpful to know that that's a pretty normal part of therapist developmental trajectory. And in my consultation, I usually kind of see that as a little cue that it might be time to pull back from learning interventions and move back into, now my focus is on connection to myself.
Yeah. And even, I mean, you make me think of the, or I'm thinking as you're talking of that, like, it's not the extremes, that we do want to learn. And of course, you're hungry for learning early, or I hope you're hungry for learning early in your career. And I hope you stay hungry for learning and are never satisfied with sort of business as usual. And that that's coming from a soaring eagle place of hope and connection to self and connection to others, as opposed to what I felt a lot of as I was sort of digging my way through in working with trauma, is find the magic thing. Like it's going to that, well, that modality is going to do it. Well, EMDR is the thing. Neurofeedback's the thing. Like sensory processing is the thing. They are all things. They, you know, and so I love the recommendation to find some of those things that you love. Mm-hmm. Maybe you go way down a certain specialty and you only do this one certain thing. Great. There's probably people that need that. And my experience is we all need a lot of the things that are coming from, you know, steady, genuine you. And so that is really part of why we invited you into this time together, is that there is just so much power in steady, genuine humans getting unsteady and steady again together. That's going to happen professionally, and that's going to happen with your clients, and that's going to happen in your families. There's no perfect therapy. There's no perfect parenting. There's no perfect social working. We show up and we mess up. And I know for me, one of the big things that I would try to shut down was any mistake, because then I failed. Mistake equals failure. Ooh, what a way to live. That's not serving my clients well. That's not serving me well.
Isn't aligned with attachment theory.
It is not.
It's just like I'm obsessed with the science, because it teaches me it's okay to just be human, which I've been desperately searching for my whole life, right? Like making zero mistakes in therapy is bad therapy. And attachment theory tells us that.
Right. I think about Ed Tronick's work. We could talk forever. I recognize there are like 2 minutes left, but So where can people find you, Robin? If they are new to your work, what is the best way for them to connect with you?
Yeah, I am pretty easy to find. Robin Goebel, robingoebel.com. But just searching Robin Goebel will take you to my website and my podcast and my book and social media. I guess those are kind of the main places that people connect with me. And my name is not totally normal. It's a little unusual. So I'm real easy to find, probably like you are.
Yes. My husband will often tell me that I'm the most famous Sanarsky. That is one of his favorite things. yes. So we'll stay connected. I know some of you came to this because you already know and are familiar with Robin's work. So I'm glad you're here. If you are new to me, hi. I love making things the invisible visible. I love these moments of connection, and you will hear a little bit more from me about the Moving Beyond Trauma-Informed course. It has just been so helpful for therapists and social workers especially, and I see some former participants in the chat talking it up, which I appreciate. And this will be the last year that I offer it in this sort of live format that it's been in. So I hope that you will join in. Otherwise, you can also find me on Instagram, is the place I'm most active, partly because I like that visual thing. And you can find my books and resources at jessicasanarsky.com.
So people are asking, how do I get in this course? So you're going to send emails.
I will send emails. And in the meantime, if you are listening to this on the go, if you go to Jessica Sinarsky, sinarski.com/transform, that is That is where you will find all the info. You can register. It starts next week. So make sure you jump on that if that's something you're interested in. I did see a question in the Q&A about where do I start with all this stuff if this is kind of newer to me. And I really designed the course to be great for those who want to dig deeper and expand their knowledge, as well as for the newbies. We sort of hit that sweet spot where I provide resources and things to go deeper if there's a certain topic in this rich world of attachment and brain and trauma that you want to dig into more. So jessicasnarski.com/transform. You will also get an email with this recording, with the certificate of attendance. All of that is coming later this week. So I'm sorry and you're welcome for all of the emails that are continuing to head your way.
Jessica, thanks for inviting me and for your continued friendship and just the relationship that we have is so grounding and important to me. So thank you.
I agree. And thank you for being willing to show up and to share this with your community and to all of you who spent your time with me and Robin here and now and who are catching this.
Are you ending this episode with maybe a big sigh of relief? Like, yes, finally, someone gets me and my kids. But also maybe a sense of like, okay, but now what? All right, y'all, I've got lots of possible now whats. If you want to connect with me directly, like pick my brain, have access to me almost every day, not to mention hundreds of other parents from around the world who totally get what it's like to be you, then you're going to want to join us in the club. We have monthly live events, including groups for siblings of dysregulated kids, a huge video library with something like 80 or 90 videos, plus transcripts and certificates of completion. Plus, of course, a very active forum that I'm participating in every single day. We open for new members periodically, so go check robingoble.com/the club. If we aren't open now, you can put yourself on the waiting list and I'll let you know the moment we open for new members. That's robingoble.com/the club. Now, if you're a professional and you want to strengthen your capacity to work with the families of kids with big baffling behaviors and vulnerable nervous systems, plus use all of my materials, including a 12-module course that follows raising kids with big baffling behaviors, plus be included in an online searchable directory so families all over the world could find you, then you're looking for Being With, which is my year-long immersive training program that runs January through December. So you'll want to go to robingoble.com/beingwith, read all about it, and if you're interested, put yourself on that waiting list too. Now, if you just maybe need a little extra connection and co-regulation, but don't feel like you need to join the club, then you can just keep listening to my podcast, or you could go subscribe to my Start Here podcast, and that'll give you 10 episodes in order that will take you through cultivating a great foundation of parenting with regulation, connection, and felt safety. That's at robingoble.com/start here. You have to go there. You can't just find it in your podcast app. Or you could get yourself a copy of Raising Kids with Big Baffling Behaviors, paper book, audio book, ebook. You can get that anywhere books are sold. Or you could just head to my website, download one of my very many free resources. I keep them all really easy to access at robingoble.com/free resources. Webinars, masterclasses, ebooks, infographics, all sorts of stuff. Go check it out. See what of those things could be supportive of you or maybe to the other adults in your life who are helping support you and your child. There are just so many ways that you and I could be more connected, and you can get the amount of co-regulation and support that you need. If it feels like a lot to remember, all you have to do is go to robingoble.com and take your time clicking around, seeing what I got there. I am so, so glad you and I are connected now. And I can't wait to be with you again soon in our next episode of the Baffling Behavior Show. Bye-bye, y'all.